Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry.
If I go from here,
an inch, she takes a mile.
Yeah, okay. I do that everywhere. Just
okay, if we can begin. We've got one bill on the agenda today, Senate File 2168, Senator Berglund's bill relative to GAMC. Senator Thomasoni moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? But I believe, Senator Berglund, you want to work off.
I have a couple of amendments.
Okay.
I'd like to start
with. We've got some testimony. Do you want to take testimony first or deal with your amendments first?
We can take the testimony.
Yeah. I've got an order of people to testify, unless there's some change in what I've been presented. The first person to testify would be Patrick Ness from Catholic Charities.
He's on his way.
Oh, he's on. Okay.
You want to take him later?
All right. Is Ms. Krinke here?
She was out in the hallway. Oh, there she is.
Dr. Doom.
Yep. From the Hospital Association.
Is it okay, Mr.?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I have with me today Dennis Doran, and Dennis is the hospital CEO up at Cambridge and made the trip down, and so I'd like to have an opportunity for Dennis to speak first. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Doran, if you could welcome the committee, if you could identify yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Doran, and I'm the president of Cambridge Medical Center, one of the 11 hospitals within the line of hospitals and clinics. Cambridge Medical Center is a relatively small institution. It's comprised of 86 beds, but we do have a large multi-specialty clinic that provides care to more than 90,000 people in a five-county area. We see over 700 patients in our clinic every day and 170,000 outpatient visits on an annual basis. The largest impact this bill has is on our behavioral health services, as we have 5% of our patients are GAMC overall, and we have about 1,600 visits. Cambridge Medical Center has 14 inpatient units, mental health beds, and 23 substance abuse beds, and see numerous mental and chemical health patients in our outpatient settings, both in Cambridge and in Mora. We're the only hospital with acute mental health and substance abuse treatment in a five-county area, which includes Isani, Kennebec, Chisago, Mille Lacs, and Pine. In addition, there are not any state mental health facilities in this five-county area, and the closest facilities are in Anoka, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Facility, and the 16-bed facility in Annandale. In 2009, our hospital had about 600 mental health admissions, inpatient admissions, about 8,300 mental health outpatient visits, 300 substance abuse inpatient admissions, and about 300 outpatient admissions, along with 4,600 substance abuse outpatient visits. Mental health and substance abuse amount to nearly 30% of our inpatient residential admissions and approximately 9% of our outpatient visits. If the GAMC program is eliminated without a solution, Cambridge Medical Center would stand to lose over $2.3 million over the next 16 months. This is over 3% of our net revenue, which puts us in the top five hardest hit hospitals in the state based on a percentage of revenue. With a line of 10 Minnesota hospitals, Cambridge is one of the facilities that fares better than others. This is due in large part to the formula crafted in this legislation. Hospitals receive payments add-ons for multiple factors, including the rural health, as well as under medical assistance discharges, and meeting certain criteria for obstetrics and, of course, the number of mental health patients served. These add-ons are not only appropriate but necessary for Cambridge to continue to provide the level of care that we do presently to these large number of patients. The mental health rate add-on provides a payment rate increase for hospitals in the top 68th percentile for the volume of mental health and chemical dependency services provided under the MA program. No one is a winner with this bill. You can't be if you go from $400 million to $200 million. But it does preserve the program, which is very, very necessary. And I'm fearful that if it isn't preserved, we're going to have more incidents of crime and violence, and we're going to have emergency room visits, and we're going to have people without prescription drugs that can control their care. So the proposal being discussed today in Senate File 2168 is the best alternative we have seen for, to the elimination of the GAMC program. On behalf of Cambridge Medical Center and all the Alina hospitals and clinics, I urge you to support the solution. Thank you.
Hey, questions for Mr. Duran? Senator Higgins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming and talking to us and putting a hometown face on this bill. Could you talk a little bit about Minnesota Care and how much of your book of business is Minnesota Care, and kind of compare that with General Assistance Medical Care?
We have a higher percentage of Minnesota Care, but I can't give you the exact number.
That's fine. And do you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Doran, do you have a sense that very many of the folks who you serve on General Assistance Medical Care could actually transition into Minnesota Care?
Chair and members, I really don't know that as well.
Thank you.
And Mr. Duran, in the event that this bill doesn't pass or the legislature does nothing, what do you end up doing within the hospital in terms of closure of programs, if any, or what would you expect to happen within?
Chair and members, what I feel will happen is that inpatient care will not go away because they're going to end up in our emergency room. So what's going to happen is the outpatient services are going to go away, which a lot of these is to control the medication for the mental health patients. As well as outpatient for substance abuse is to make sure that they stay off the drug of choice. So the inpatient, I would keep on because I'm going to get them anyway through our emergency room. Might go down a few beds, but it'll be the outpatient programs that will really suffer.
Okay, well, let me ask then relative to that. You indicated that one of the outpatient programs would be for folks who have some type of mental health problems who come to the clinics for ongoing medication. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
That's accurate. What happens, Chair, is that your mental health patients, a lot of them get medication management on a regular basis, and I would see that perhaps going away. And furthermore, there wouldn't be any prescriptions for them. So,
it's the consequence of that, that they decompensate and they show up in the ER. Is that, Mr. Random, would I be mistaken relative to that?
A lot of times that will happen. They'll show up in the emergency room, which is more expensive.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, how, absent some fix to the program then, you've indicated outpatient services would go away, but at least if my anecdotal supposition is correct, and you're suggesting you think it might be, that then they show up back in inpatient ER services, thereby exacerbating the cost to the ER room.
That is, Chair, that is correct.
Okay, so you still haven't covered the cost then?
That is also correct, Chair.
Okay, so let's say a year from now, because this is, what, a 16-month fix, Senator Berglund?
Yes. That,
okay, so just hypothetically, and I realize these are hypotheticals today, or at least to some extent, although I could ask what you've experienced up to the present time. But let's say 16 months from now, 12 months from now, there is no fix to this to the administration and the legislature. My hypothetical is correct. You're now losing money anyways. What do you do at that point? You've closed the inpatient services.
Chair.
Go to the county board and ask for something, or what happens?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, if this continues on where we don't have any funding, we'll close down the inpatient unit. We won't have any choice. And then what's going to happen is those patients are going to go in the emergency room, and then we're going to try to disperse them someplace else. Right now, we've even, our unit's full. There's no place to put these patients. Sometimes they end up in Fargo.
Okay, and we're talking about people with some type of serious mental health concerns. Is that correct?
That's correct. Or substance abuse.
So, all right, so you would close your inpatient unit would be the next step.
Correct.
And then somebody shows up who has some significant schizoaffective disorder, whatever, you would have to look for some alternative receiving hospital, transport them by sheriff to that hospital?
Mr. Chair, what normally would happen is that we would try to find a bed someplace in the state or in the area, and then they would have to be transported if they were dangerous by law enforcement. We would try to obviously triage them in our emergency room, but eventually would have to disperse them.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I think you have stumbled upon one of our biggest struggles here in Minnesota, and that is the underpayments in our mental health care system. And when you see the formula that has been developed in this spreadsheet, we are putting additional resources into mental health. And quite frankly, these hospitals that have chosen to provide mental health services have been doing so at a loss for many, many years. And quite frankly, that is one of the reasons that I regret some of the discussion about who the winners and losers are on this sheet of paper, because quite frankly, the hospitals that have chosen to provide inpatient mental health services for their community, and as Mr. Doran said today, it's the only such service in the five counties that he serves. So we have chosen to put some additional resources with this Medicaid surcharge into our mental health system. So you have stumbled upon the problem that if GAMC goes away, we have some real holes in our system.
Ms. Krinke, what you're suggesting presupposes the bill passes, you know, becomes law. My hypothetical is, you know, if it doesn't, Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, it's not just a hospital infrastructure problem that's being created with the if this program ends. It's also a community-based infrastructure problem. I'll give you an example. If you're running a Rule 5 facility and 30% of your patients are on general assistance medical care, and then they no longer have that care and they no longer have their medications, it will not be very long before they're not able to stay in the housing. And if you lose 30% of your revenue for your housing, it becomes a question as to whether you're going to be able to sustain the other 70% of your operations.
Well, I'm not much of an expert on GAMC, although I've spent some time with you, Senator Berglund, and tried to, on my own, develop some better sense of the program, but strikes me, Ms. Doran, your testimony certainly lends itself to kind of the circular nature of this. I don't know what the cost would be, but if somebody, again, let's take my mental health situation. If somebody decompensates, shows up in the ER, you have no outpatient services. I mean, you've suspended outpatient services to provide ongoing medication. So they decompensate. They show up in the ER. The cost 12 months from now is such that you don't have the inpatient services anymore for them. By definition, they're dangerous to the extent that, depending on the level of mental health problems, they're not going to transport themselves to a hospital 50 miles away, nor are you going to let them get into a car by themselves to do so, I assume. You know, if they don't have hypothetically the capability to drive, so now the county sheriff is going to transport them, and I'm not sure what the cost to county sheriffs throughout the state would be. So you got that cost, but it also then presupposes that I don't know what the repository hospitals would be. I assume Regions and HCMC. Would that, I mean, you mentioned Fargo, but you're closer to what, Regions? or Hennepin County?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we're much closer to Hennepin and Regions, and the truth of the matter is that if they get flooded with patients, there's not going to be any beds. And so what happens even today, if you don't, there's beds are closing, have closed in the past, and there just isn't available beds, so you search for the nearest available bed.
Okay, and that's why you suggested Fargo as a potential.
I'm just giving that as an example, Mr. Chair, is that Regions and Hennepin are filled, and other facilities in the Twin City area are filled, then you go to the next available location.
You know, I think one of the things we do in this place is we often see things through the prism of our geographies, obviously. As a St. Paul legislator, I'm most conversant with regions. I also have, I mentioned this yesterday in a private meeting, Senator Betzel and I actually have some experience with the commitment courts in Ramsey and Hennepin, so I have some sense of what's going on at Regions just as a legal practitioner. And if the expectation is that Chisago, Pine, go through the list of counties, everybody's going to show up at Regions. No, they're not going to show up at Regions unless Regions is going to start building new units. They're already, looking at additional, if I'm not mistaken, additional mental health space. So I'm not the expert, but it seems that this is a problem that just kind of keeps on descending in circular fashion.
Mr. Chair, that's accurate. And I don't know how many people realize this, but when Hennepin and Regents get filled up, they send the patients to Cambridge for hospitalization.
Okay.
And because there aren't any beds available. So as mental health and substance abuse beds become more and more scarce, I mean, everybody works together to try to serve that patient. And what my concern is that's going to go away.
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, and I guess whoever would like to try to answer this, on the sheets that we had from yesterday, I'm assuming that the ones that you handed out are the same ones, the charts. And I noticed that Cambridge does see an increase. They're one of the 21 that would be considered the winners. I know we don't like those words, but can we then attribute those 21 winners to the fact that they have mental health care? Is that the relationship then? So every one of these.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the various columns, and I know we're kind of jumping ahead here, we put some additional resources into OB, hospitals that had high volumes of OB patients, hospitals that had high volumes of mental health patients. We put some resources into hospitals that were located in the cities of class tier 3 and 4. So we were trying, in essence, to mitigate some of the impact of the surcharge. So in answer to your question, Senator Fishbach, yes, I think part of the reason that Cambridge would be viewed on this sheet as quote-unquote a winner, and I do think it is important to note that right now Medicaid payments in Minnesota are at 2002 costs minus 14.4%. So our Medicaid program pays substantially below our costs. So to say that this hospital is a winner is not really quite fair. But in essence, according to this chart and the way we've done the surcharge mechanism, Cambridge Hospital, because of the mental health add-on, got additional resources. And our association made a decision that we would have an opportunity with this surcharge to put additional resources to those providers that had been providing mental health services. We thought it was the right thing to do. So.
And Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, maybe we could just say that some of these folks receive additional monies while others take significant cuts, as opposed to saying winners and losers. Maybe we could say it that way, because it doesn't seem reasonable that maybe we could rework some of these numbers when a lot of these smaller hospitals are taking significantly more cuts, and then I see hospitals on here that are actually going to be getting additional money. And so that's what concerns me, that we can't, when you say that we're trying to mitigate, potentially, you know, we're not mitigating the effects on some of these smaller hospitals when they're taking gigantic, bigger cuts than they would under existing law.
Well, Senator Fischbach, I didn't mean to jump into what might be more appropriate for committee debate, but as I understand this, somebody, Senator Berglund, witnesses, people who are more expert than I, I think this is here because of the governor's veto, and this bill's here on kind of an emergency basis, as I understand it. And I assume, like any such legislation, it's far from perfect, since the perfect solution would have been otherwise. Like, don't veto the GMC program, I'm guessing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I jumped ahead. This is the third time I've heard the bill, so I'm jumping ahead. But and maybe Ms. Krinke is going to explain the chart again, but I'm talking about the difference between existing law with the unallotments, with what the governor's actions, and then if Senate File 2168 was to go into law. So there's talking about the difference, not what happened last year, but like what the difference would be is the existing law in this bill today. So,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that we realize, and I think the discussion that Mr. Dorn has led us through helps us understand that hospitals are not independent entities that stand on their own. They are a part of a system. So the smaller hospitals that are around Cambridge rely on Cambridge to provide services to their residents that they can't provide or choose not to provide. And if those services aren't available at Cambridge, then the people in that area all are losers. And those hospitals, those smaller hospitals then, are in the position of trying to find a bed to serve a patient somewhere much farther from home, and maybe they can find one and maybe they can't. But we do have a hospital system in Minnesota. There is no hospital that stands by itself without relying on others in the system to serve their patients.
Further testimony or questions? Ms. Krinke, haven't had a chance to formally testify.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Just a quick couple statements. Earlier this year, our board at the Minnesota Hospital Association came forward with two key priorities for us to guide our decision-making. The first one was to preserve coverage for as many Minnesotans as we can, and that means a restored and reformed GAMC program so that we can keep coverage for our poorest and sickest citizens here in the state. The second priority was to leverage as much federal money as we possibly can. And given the state of our overall budget this year and the $1.2 billion shortfall, given what is on the horizon with next year's budget shortfall, and the fact that we have a governor that is not really willing to raise new revenues, we have very limited options on the table for us. So we looked at this Medicaid surcharge as a way to bring in an additional $100 million to help provide a portion of the GAMC solution. And I know that the Medicaid surcharge is not a perfect solution, but it is a positive solution to help restore this program. And I know that everybody has to look at the sheets and see how their individual hospitals do. But it is important that we believe that the hospital community is stepping forward to say we believe a solution must be found and that this Medicaid surcharge is a way to help us leverage additional federal monies. And I know the mechanism is a little cumbersome, but basically the federal government allows states to leverage up to their upper payment limits between the Medicare and the Medicaid program. So what Senator Berglund has in this bill is a mechanism that allows us to get all of the federal money that is available to our state. Other states around the country are doing this, and quite frankly, we've been letting this money sit on the table. So we need to bring that money back to Minnesota to plug into our Medicaid program and to help come up with a funding mechanism for GAMC. And as Mr. Doran said, you can't take the GAMC program, which was $400 million, and that was $400 million a year, and squeeze it into a 16-month program with about half the money. So we're not going to be able to make everybody whole. So that's
Ms. Krinke, this might be unfair, but to ask you, but since you raised the governor's posture, is it a fair statement, and maybe I should better direct this to Senator Berglund, is it a fair statement that irrespective of what the fix is, the governor or at least his administration, his agencies are interested in some fix to the veto? Is that a fair statement or unfair statement?
Mr. Chairman, I'll let
Mr. Chairman, I can only take his veto letter at what it said. It said, I am vetoing the second year of this program. That will give the legislature time to fix it before the veto would go into effect. And that's what we've worked to do, and we work to do it keeping in mind a variety of things that would be important to the governor. So this program is paid for without new tax dollars. It is a program that will live within its means. There is language in the bill to make sure that the money we have is the money we spend and we don't spend more than we have. I know those are all important things to the governor, and they are included in this bill. It's important to the provider community and others that we maintain coverage for as many people as possible. So over the 16 months, this will provide coverage to about 85,000 people. As we have heard the testimony, many of these people suffer from mental illness and or chemical dependency. So these folks will continue to need medications. That is important. And in the bill, we do not cut reimbursement for medications. So, because we know how important that is as a component of this program. We do cut other provider payments, but we had to prioritize, and the priority was to maintain prescription coverage.
It's possible we're doing this a little bit in reverse to the extent that the request had been to take testimony, and maybe we should have had the explanation of the bill first. But my concern from a financial point of view then is, if the governor's veto message suggested that there was the need to fix the program, and the governor's veto was one of, and I'm inferring from that veto message that the governor's position was one of necessity, got to balance the budget, and I'm not necessarily saying this is my position, but if I would infer or even take some of the governor's position that from last year that legislature hasn't done this, I got to figure out how to do it, leads us to the present situation where everybody then says there has to be some kind of fix. The $5.4 billion deficit for 12-13 is going to be another $700 million absent a fix because, it wouldn't be, if we assume there has to be a fix, you would add that to the deficit if we don't fix it. And if we fix it on a temporary basis, we still have that problem on top of the 5.4, arguably. Okay, well, that's interesting. Sir Olson.
Mr. Chair, kind of along that line, what in your proposal is, does anything in your proposal control the exponential growth that this program is projected to have and has been having?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, as I said, this bill is paid for. It helps solve $160 million of the deficit. It keeps the health care access fund solvent, and therefore we would not anticipate people in that program losing their coverage in the future as well. And it allows the commissioner to ratably reduce rates further to providers if for some reason we have more people coming into the program than we anticipated, or the services they need are more expensive than we have had in the past. So we live within the appropriation that's in the bill. The bill creates a special fund for general assistance medical care, and these surcharge dollars and other monies in the bill are deposited in that account to pay for this program. And so if the money appears not to be sufficient at some time in the future, then the commissioner is authorized to further reduce payments to providers to make sure we don't overspend.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just have one other comment I'd like to make, and then I'll go sit down and let Senator Berglund present her bill. If the governor's proposal were to be implemented, it requires a $111 million transfer from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund. And there's also a $48 million transfer currently in the books from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund. So ironically, if we support and pass and implement Senator Berglund's bill, it actually reduces our budget deficit by $159 million. Because what we're doing is we're substituting federal money in for the solution. So as all of the finance division chairs here today, and as you all are struggling to how you're going to come up with solving this budget shortfall that we have, this bill helps solve our budget deficit by $159 million. And so as someone who's going to be before Senator Berglund's committee, the nursing homes, lots of other entities looking to maintain their current level of funding, I think it's very difficult to walk away from a solution that already reduces our problem by $159 million.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I listened to the archive of the last meeting that you had, and was particularly noting a hospital administrator that serves a good chunk of my area, Bob Stevens, and they are hit hard by your proposal, as are others. Is there anything that has been adjusted or changed in your proposal before it comes to us today that minimizes that negative impact on some of our really excellent hospitals? And how do you handle, Ms. Krinke, the fact that many of your members are being very negatively affected by this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Olson, first of all, I think that to say that it negatively impacts many members, I think we have to be fair and say that we don't know where that next expensive GAMC case is going to show up. This analysis is a snapshot looking back a year ago. We don't know where the next car accident or where the next farm accident, you don't know what next year's picture is exactly going to look like. So having coverage for this population is important. That's the first comment. The other comment that this proposal actually puts money back into the Medicaid program, and I know that this formula looks a little goofy, but we have some of our hospitals that have been blessed by not having very large book of Medicaid services. So I'm not trying to make light of the fact that Waconia is perhaps hurt by this formula. Waconia has been blessed with a pretty darn good payer mix over the years. And I know you can look at this and say that Bemidji Hospital is doing very well under this formula. Bemidji has one of the highest GAMC book of businesses, one of the highest Medicaid book of businesses, one of the highest Medicare book of businesses. So if you look at Bemidji in comparison to Waconia, I doubt that Mr. Stevens would want to change his payer mix with the Bemidji Hospital's payer mix. So it's I know that it doesn't look right on paper, but I think sometimes we have to step back and say, this is the right thing to do for our communities. Now, in terms of all the hospitals that you mentioned, one of the factors that is not included on our sheets is the impact to our critical access hospitals. And this is something that a lot of people don't realize, but hospitals in Minnesota that have less than 25 beds have status from the federal government as critical access hospitals. And this is important because they are maintaining services in remote areas of our state. So the federal government has said they will pay 101% of costs on a Medicare cost report. So for the hospitals that are critical access hospitals, they will be able to put this surcharge on their cost reports and based on what percentage of their services is Medicare, they will get that percentage back. So, for instance, if that you have a hospital on this list that has $200,000 worth of surcharges in rural Minnesota, and they have 50% of their business is in Medicare, they would get half of it back. So it's not perfect, but I think the impact to our rural hospitals on these sheets has been overstated.
And, Mr. Chairman, Berlin, all of the pink salmon-colored on this handout are critical access hospitals. So it's quite a bit of the hospitals in Minnesota that would not suffer the entire
I don't think
loss.
We have that.
We didn't get it
we got
in color.
Black and white.
We got black and
well,
white.
I know the ones you've got aren't in color. If you want to pass this around and look at it.
Maybe you could color them for us as the hearing proceeds. Further.
Thank you. I'll be here if anybody has. I okay. feel like Senator Berglund should kind of go through the bill. I'll
well,
sit down.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Senator Berglund, I know you have a couple of other witnesses.
Yeah,
did
we
you
might
want?
As well finish the witnesses
okay.
now that we've started them.
So we have Mr. Ness and Mr. Shannon and Mr. Gunkley, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Ness. I'm the Public Policy Manager for Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Apologize for being late this morning. I was stuck in the snow in my alley. And I knew that I had to get here, and I was stuck for a long time and getting frustrated. And lots of my neighbors passed me by. And then finally someone came, and they pushed me out. And I was thinking, it's kind of what we're doing here today. A lot of folks have been kind of passed by the GMC population since the end of May. And we're here to ask you to kind of push us along. And when that neighbor finally came, I was reminded of that Minnesota spirit that we're all so proud of, and hope that we can continue that in this committee today. I am, and my organization is part of the Save GMC Coalition. We're a broad-based coalition statewide of over 40 organizations representing consumer and low-income advocates, labor and faith groups, providers, social service organizations, and others who are deeply concerned about the elimination of funding for a GMC. Our number one goal has always been to protect the eligibility for the poorest and sickest and to continue in some fashion this program that Minnesota has invested in for the last 35 years. Under Republican and Democratic leadership, under intense and deep recessions and budget shortfalls, we've always found it not only the fiscally prudent thing to do, but simply the right thing to do to continue this program. While this bill on the table is certainly imperfect and only a temporary solution, our coalition does strongly support it. And thanks, Senator Berglund, and all the legislators who have invested so much time over the months. And a special thank you to the Minnesota Hospital Association, who has really done fantastic work. We think that it's very important that this proposal preserves affordable co-payments for enrollees in the program. It's a critical piece in order for the program to be effective and, more importantly, for the folks who are on the program to stay healthy. As you know, many GMC enrollees only earn $203 a month. That's about $2,500 a year. Just imagine, $203 a year. They're perhaps your brothers and sisters in understanding tight budgets and the sacrifices that you have to make. And so they certainly understand the situation that you're in. We know a man, work with a man named Franklin. He has a degree in social work. He also was a construction worker on local highway projects. He now has terminal prostate cancer. He takes 10 medications a day. And under the switch to Minnesota Care, that would cost a minimum of $50 for the premium and the co-pays, a minimum. And that doesn't include the 10%, the hospital co-pay, and the $10,000 limit. It's undoable. For Franklin, And right now, GAMC is keeping him alive. Now, and from our coalition perspective, and certainly from Catholic Charities working in the community, we understand the connection between housing and healthcare. If people are off their meds, they will not be able to keep their housing. You will see more people talking to themselves on the street. You will see more people sleeping under bridges and taking the bus as long as they can as their shelter. That is a guarantee under this plan, without doing anything. To the senators on this committee, we ask for your leadership. You are the last line of defense for the over 70,000 most vulnerable Minnesotans who benefit from this program. Please help protect the basic dignity and care that is provided through general assistance medical care. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to bring up Kevin Shannon for a short testimony.
Certainly. Mr. Shannon, thanks for coming. And just, you know, if you can just identify yourself, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Finance Committee, it's my privilege to be here to testify to the importance of making sure that general assistance medical care remain available to all Minnesotans, the neediest of our fellow Minnesotans. My name is Kevin Shannon, and I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. I have a degree from St. Olaf College. I have a Master of Divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, with a concentration in Christian social ethics. I am an ordained pastor in one of the mainline denominations, Protestant denominations. I'm also a valuable member of our community here in Minnesota as a volunteer in my neighborhood and community, serving on various task forces and citizen advisory boards over the years. I have raised, along with their mother, two exceptional young adults who are both in graduate school. I left the active ministry in 1994 in order to stay near my children when they were young, as our marriage was ending in divorce. Many of the years since, I supported myself by hard work as a realtor, starting from scratch and making a living for 11 years. Since that income fell on hard times a couple of years ago, I began looking for full-time work elsewhere. Unfortunately, also about 3 years ago, through the confusion and ambiguity of a messy on-again, off-again end of a relationship, a misdemeanor was added to my name. It was not from any act of violence or theft or other serious crime. However, the consequences have stayed with me long after the probation was served. This relatively minor crime has kept me from at least three excellent jobs for which I was a finalist, of which I know, and who knows how many others. During that time, I have survived, though it has been a struggle through a combination of part-time incomes. Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, when you think of recipients of GAMC, you may rightfully have in your mind an image of a person who lives on the street, who may or may not have any education, who perhaps never had a very good job or position within our society. But when I lost both of my remaining part-time jobs in December and early January, I became another kind of face for you to remember. I still can't quite believe I'm where I am, but I qualified for food stamps and GAMC benefits in late December. I am GAMC, too. I'm trying to find work. I do not find it comfortable to be receiving government assistance. Sometimes in the face of judgment from others, and trust me, it's not comfortable here to be revealing my situation, I have to remind myself that I have worth as a human being, that I have skills that someday soon, I hope, will be utilized in an economically contributing way, and that I do have energy and ambition to be somewhere else than the spot I'm in now. I do not expect that I will need GAMC for a very long time, but then again, I never expected I would need it at all. I suffer from depression and need prescription medications daily. I'm very fortunate that for the moment, GAMC helps me get those meds and the doctor visits that go with them, and will cover me if I need more care unexpectedly. I am another face of GAMC. I've learned that it can be any of us at any time. Things happen to people. Life is often traveled in anything but straight lines. Even when, and I hope it can be soon, I don't need GAMC coverage anymore, I will continue to use my voice to speak for those who have little or no voice. This is my story, but it is about more than just me, of course. It is about who we are as a society. The work of this committee is part of the budgeting function of state government. Budgets and how we spend our mutual resources, as I'm sure you know, are in one way or another moral and ethical statements. How we do this tells in very concrete ways who it is that we have become. How we care for or don't care for the greatest times of need for our neighbor will determine whether or not we can claim any moral or ethical integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, we must restore GAMC funding. Thank you for this opportunity to contribute this testimony, and please, please do the right thing soon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shannon, for joining us with your testimony. And I don't know if there are particular questions for Mr. Shannon or Mr. Ness. I know, Mr. Ness, you had somebody else you wish to have testify.
With permission to bring up Mr. Gary Gunkel.
Mr. Gunkel, welcome to the committee. And again, if you might identify yourself and offer your whatever thoughts you might have to us.
Good morning, everybody, and Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Gary Gunkel. And I appreciate you listening to why I'm asking for support of this legislation. For I'm here representing just not myself, but other GAMC participants. I was born in Wydena, Minnesota, and eventually moved from the farm to South St. Paul. After high school, I found out I had a low draft number for Vietnam. So I asked if I enlisted, could I spend the summer at working at my grandparents' farm? Then I went to Fort Sam Houston, where I became a rifle expert and a medic. I was in an ambulance company in Germany of the 7th Brigade, which was a medical unit. From one of my sergeants, I learned a few things, like an ink pen can be your best friend or your enemy's worst nightmare. It can be used as a weapon, or you can even use it for a tracheotomy or a splice in an artery. See, in Vietnam, I was told that medics was a prize catch because the Vietnamese could use you to work on their guys at the expense of soldiers. If you ever saw the movie MASH, those were the type of ambulances that we drove back then. Later years, I did some farming, worked at the VA for 7 years, and managed for restaurants in 15. In August of 2008, I was living in Invergrove Heights, heading for work at Mystic Lake, where I worked security for 9 years. A deer entered the road on 35E, and the result accident of my SUV caused back injury and ongoing headaches. I lost my job in the fall of 2008. I began using GAMC in October of 2008 to address my injuries. This was a godsend, for I was waiting for veterans' benefits to kick in. And it's been a while for it finally started to kick in. I was sharing an apartment at this time with my son. Until last year, my son was laid off as a cook and entered the military full time. When he left, I couldn't afford the rent and lost my housing. I lived with a friend for a few months, but during this past year, I have not had stable housing. Hoping to get some help through the VA, through the VASH program, but that hasn't happened yet. For some vets, GMC is a bridge until federal support can comes. But that can take years. I'm representing other veterans, like I said, who need this bill passed to allow access when it is almost when they need it the most. I made not one sacrifice to protect vulnerable, but by serving our country, I made two sacrifices. My son has arrived in Afghanistan this week with the 101st Airborne Division. Thank you for seeing the sacrifices I've made and others. to protect the vulnerable of our country. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for either witness? Thank you. Mr. Ness, I'm going to ask, appreciate your bringing folks with you to put more of a face on this, but let me ask you just, you indicated that those who are enrolled in GAMC have a monthly income of, you mentioned the $203 figure, is that?
The limit is around $8,000, but we think probably around half are on just general assistance, the $203
okay.
a month.
The vast majority have, you know, 10 to 20% of the maximum allowable income to be in this program.
But a number of the folks are limited to the general assistance 203, is that correct?
That's correct.
That's, what, like a couple days per diem that all of us so quickly grab, I think. Isn't it? It's about that amount, I think. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thanks to all the witnesses for your testimony. Senator Berglund, again, I know you indicated you wanted to have some discussion with the witnesses to kind of lay the stage for what's going on out there. If you could present the bill to us in terms of, I know it's been through, obviously, your division, Senator Tomasoni's division. There are a lot of members of the legislature who've had a chance to work with it, as Senator Fischbach pointed out. But if you could offer some description of the bill to us, and I don't know if you want either yourself or Mr. Albrecht to talk about the finances of the bill, how it's structured, that'd be helpful to the full committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just start by offering a couple of amendments. I have an A10 amendment, and this is technical language that was requested by the Department of Human Services, and our staff's been really busy working hard on this bill, and we didn't see it on the computer until last night. So the A10 amendment, I'll just go through the explanation briefly. Line 1.3 is technical. Lines 1.4 to 1.9 amends the language granting the psychiatric and burn services rate increase. The increase may be adjusted in order to comply with federal law and cannot be implemented before federal approval. Lines 1.10 to 1.12 correct cross-references. Lines 1.13 to 1.32 rewrite the language of the intergovernmental transfer designed to increase health plan payments to HCMC and Regents. The only policy change from the current language is to state the amount of the transfer rather than to have the amount set by DHS. And the amounts are up to $12 million per year from Hennepin County and up to $6 million per year from Ramsey County. Lines 1.33 to 2.15 clarify language regarding the intergovernmental transfer from Hennepin and Ramsey counties designed to increase DSH payments to HCMC and Regents. This language also gives DHS the authority to adjust the transfers and payments to comply with federal law and states that the provision will not be implemented until we receive federal approval. Lines 2.16 to 2.32 reinstate language inadvertently omitted from the bill that gives DHS the authority to transfer money from the new GAMC account to the general fund or the healthcare access fund to make Medicaid and Minnesota care payments as required by the bill. So this is a technical amendment.
Okay. We have Senator Berglund's motion. Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of technical amendments to the amendment. On page 2, after line 16, I think those two new paragraphs were supposed to be a part of a new subdivision. So this would insert after line 16, subdivision 8, transfers.
I would incorporate that into the amendment.
And the references on lines 20 and 27 to the new account should be 256D.032 rather than 031.
So I incorporate that into the amendment as well.
And further on lines 19 and 26, when it says transfer amounts appropriated to the account. I think it should be appropriated from the account.
I would incorporate that into the amendment as well.
Okay, we have Senator Berglund's A-10 amendment with the incorporated changes as suggested by counsel. Is there further discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, then I have a appropriation corrections amendment A-11. This just corrects a lot of numbers in the bill, in the appropriations section.
A lot of numbers?
A lot of numbers.
Mr. Mossman, how about those lot of numbers?
Mr. Chair and members, the divisions just made some technical and adjustments yesterday to some of the increases in surcharge rates and other things, and the tweaking of those resulted in appropriation numbers that we didn't have until following that meeting, and this puts the appropriations article in conformity with those.
Okay. We have Senator Merglin's motion on the A11 amendment. Is there a discussion or question? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, then I'll just briefly go through the bill. We felt that reforming the mental health delivery system would be an important component of the bill because, as we've heard, a lot of individuals that are served by this program have mental health needs. And so we have created in the bill a mental health urgent care and psychiatric consultation provision. We have also provided a program for rapid access to psychiatry by patients who are hospitalized. And we've provided for a collaborative psychiatric consultation program. This is all handled through the state-operated services, and this will have some savings in the bill as a result of reduced hospitalizations. The bill then does impose a Medicaid surcharge. It increases the surcharge on hospitals from the 1.56 that we have today to a 3.95% from March 1st, 2010 until September 30th. And then it drops it down to 3.06 from October 1st, 2010 to June 30th, 2011. The reason for the difference in percentages over the 16-month period is because we enter a new fiscal year and we have a different Medicare upper limit. It also temporarily increases the 0.6% health maintenance organization surcharge to 4% from March 1st, 2010 to June 30th, 2011 and establishes a temporary 4.0% surcharge on county-based purchasing plans for the same period of time. The bill delays hospital rebasing by 6 months, and it continues a ratable reduction to hospital MA inpatient rates that is on the books today. The bill also will reinstate the quarterly payments that we have through the DRG program. We use the General Assistance Medical Care program to match those federal dollars. So with the veto of the General Assistance Medical Care program, hospitals were also going to lose those quarterly payments. And this bill will reinstate those payments. Then we have in the bill various the formula for the Medicaid increases, and those are reflected in the chart that you have. And if there are any questions about that, we can probably answer those at the end. We also have modified language in the bill establishing fixed voluntary intergovernmental transfers from Hennepin and Ramsey County. This helps them leverage more Medicaid money for their programs without affecting either the upper payment limit or affecting the amount of money that other hospitals can get from DSH payments. We have a rate increase in here also for managed care plans. We create a special fund for depositing the funds that are created in the bill for the GAMC program. And all of the funds in the bill must be deposited into the GAMC account. Most folks who are in the program today would continue to be eligible for the program, but we have eliminated some eligibility for individuals with incomes greater than 75% of poverty were eligible for a hospital-only GMC program that is being eliminated in this temporary program. And we are eliminating individuals who have private health care coverage or are in a county correctional or detention facility or who are admitted as an inpatient to a hospital on a criminal hold order or who reside in a sex offender program, as well as those who do not cooperate with the county or state in applying for Social Security disability. We make no changes in the GAMC Bridge program that allows certain individuals in GAMC to transition into Minnesota Care, but we do have language in the bill that clarifies that that is not intended for the entire GAMC population. There is a provision in the bill that allows counties, if they choose to receive their money in a block grant form and to contract with providers in their area to provide services on a managed care basis. We have the ratable reductions that are in the bill for facilities that provide GAMC services. There are no changes to pharmaceutical programs. There is a 50% ratable reduction for outpatient care, and there is either a 60 or a 69% reduction to inpatient care, depending on what county your hospital is in. We have language in here, as I said earlier, that gives the commissioner the authority to adjust rates on a quarterly basis to assure that the total aggregate amount paid out for services does not exceed the appropriations available. We also deposit money that we receive from drug rebates based on the drug utilization in the GAMC program into the new account. We also have recoveries that are made through the GAMC program from other insurance or from the federal Social Security disability and Medicaid programs into the GAMC account. We've temporarily suspend implementation of certain sections of the current GAMC law while this temporary program is in effect. And we modify the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association assessment for health partners in calendar year 2010 and 2011 by providing a $35 million credit to their assessment allocations. And we transfer out of the special fund $35 million to the Commissioner of Commerce to make those payments to the MSHA program. This additional $35 million will help health partners who operates Regions Hospital and is greatly affected by the loss of the GAMC program to better sustain those losses. I can answer questions about the bill now, Mr. Chairman, or we can have Dennis Albrecht go over the fiscal note for you.
Let's have Mr. Albrecht discuss the fiscal note and the way you've put the bill together. And members, you do have a spreadsheet relative to the bill that's in the packet. Okay, Mr. Albrecht.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to go over the sheet that looks like this rather than the formal fiscal note because I think it's a little bit easier to see all of
Mr.
the
Chair,
different
could
components.
Mr. Senjum?
Should you face that our way?
I'm sorry.
It's a sheet that looks
one that
like
looks
this.
Like this.
It's titled Fiscal Summary. Okay. Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair and members, the first 18 lines summarize the various components of the bill that result in additional revenue. The lines 2 and 3 are actually, it's just line 3, I'm sorry, is just a little bit of additional FFP that comes into the general fund. That's related
FFP
to the
what?
Mental health urgent care provisions.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Could you, like, tell us what the acronyms mean? Like FFP?
It's additional federal funding, matching funds. Beginning on line 7 are the amounts that are going to go into the special revenue fund. That's the GAMC account that would administer the new temporary program. Line 7 is the MA Medical Assistance Hospital surcharge. That's $194.6 million. Line 8 is the additional surcharge on HMOs and county-based purchasing programs. That is $189 million. Line 10 is a little bit of FFP, $123,000. Line 10 is the DISH funds that Senator Berglund mentioned. That's $18 million in the 2010-11 biennium and $12 million in the TAILS. Line 11 shows the amount that would be recovered under those various provisions that Senator Berglund described, and that is about $7.9 million with $9.4 million in the TAILS. Line 12 is the amount that comes from the drug rebates. That's $8 million with about $2.8 million in fiscal year 2012 as well. Line 13 reflects a transfer from the general fund for administration of the program. This is money that is currently spent in the department on administering GAMC, and it does go back to the department for that purpose. Line 14 is a transfer of what will be or projected to be unspent appropriations to the current GAMC program. That would be a transfer from the general fund into the new special revenue fund account. The bill reduces two grants to counties, the adult mental health grants and the children and community services grants, by $19.1 million, and it transfers that money out of the general revenue fund into the special revenue fund.
Thank you.
Beginning on line 23 are the expenditures in the bill. These would be the general fund expenditures. Line 23 is the amount, the net amount for the mental health urgent care provisions. The rest of these are all reductions in expenditures in the general fund. The delay in the hospital or the rebasing that Senator Berglund described is $9.7 million with $12.7 million in the TAILS. The modification on line 25 of the hospital rate reductions is $118,000 with $87,000 in the TAILS.
I can go to the audit.
Line 26 is the reduction in the operating and administration funds for the department that go get transferred into the GAMC account. Similarly, line 27 is showing the reduction in expenditures of the $60.4 million from the current GAMC appropriation, and also on line 28, that is the corresponding appropriation reduction for the county grants. In the special revenue fund, beginning on line 32 through 36, those amounts are the MA portion of the various rate increases that are in the bill that Senator Berglund described. Line 37 is the portion of the increases that goes to HMOs. And line 38 is the expenses in the temporary GAMC program, $307.5 million in 2010 and 11. And the amounts in all of those areas that show up in 12 and 13 are amounts that would be used to pay the obligations that are incurred through June 30th, 2011. It's just that they won't be settled until sometime in the next biennium. Lines 39 and 40, you've seen at least the amounts on line 39 before. That's the administrative money, and then line 40 is a small amount of systems cost for the Department of Human Services in fiscal year 2010. Lines 49 to 53 show the transfers that I have already mentioned, with the exception of lines 52 and 53. Those are the transfers that are currently reflected in the November forecast, the $159 million that would move between the general fund and the health care access fund. Line 62 shows the net result of everything in the bill for the general fund. In fiscal year 10 and 11, there's a $168.7 million savings, and in 12 and 13, there is a $13.2 million savings over both biennia. That's a savings to the general fund of $182 million. On line 63, this is the fund from which the temporary GAMC program is administered. It has savings in 2010 and 11 of $71.9 million. And spending in 12 and 13 of $69.3 million. So overall, over both biennia, there's a $3 million surplus in that fund. And the net result on the health care access fund is on line 64, $94.9 million savings in 2010 and 11, and a $31.3 million savings in 12 and 13 for overall savings over both biennia of $126 million in that fund.
Okay. So, Mr. Ulbricker, Senator Berglund, where does that leave us then? Or maybe, Senator Berglund, maybe I could ask you as to where you would anticipate that leaves us in terms of the healthcare access fund or utilization of the fund.
The healthcare access fund is balanced and will be able to continue serving the anticipated number of people through the rest of this biennium and into part of the next biennium.
Okay, so obviously that's a separate issue in terms of a projected deficit in the healthcare access fund.
We already had a projected deficit in the healthcare access fund in the next biennium. We would prefer to address that issue after we know if healthcare reform is going to pass. Healthcare reform would have a major positive impact on the healthcare access fund, according to our projections.
health care reform at a federal level.
Yes.
Okay, don't hold your breath, but...
if not, then we'll have to deal with that, but we knew that last session, or I mean last year of the session.
So the governor's veto, again, was a $700 million. What was the exact line item veto of the governor's?
You mean the amount?
Yes.
Well, there was a veto, and then there was an unallotment.
Yes.
And together, they nearly made a $400
million. Okay, and that was for a 12-month period. Is that correct?
Right.
So over a biennium, arguably that's...
Well, it was a 13-month period. With the unallotment.
And
we are covering a 16-month period.
And the unallotment, of course, doesn't continue into the next biennium, but the veto does.
No, the veto doesn't.
No, I mean it's...
The unallotment doesn't, the veto doesn't.
How does
you can't veto a future legislature's appropriation.
But it's an existing ongoing program.
It is a statutory program.
Okay. So the money's not there for the program in the future.
Well, we don't know. You could say there's no money in the future for any program.
Right. Okay, but
the whole budget, because we anticipate a budget deficit. This program, in my opinion, should not be singled out. It should be on the table with every other program in the next biennium, and we should be looking at it because it is a very important safety net program.
But for our budgeting purposes, we're in the hole in the next biennium, absent some kind of a fix for this program.
Absence a fix for the whole budget.
Right.
We're in the hole.
Okay.
This program is not making or breaking the next biennial budget.
Mr. Chairman, we're in the current program before the veto is in the forecast, in other words, as
yes.
being fully funded.
Yes.
Before the veto.
Before the veto.
Yeah.
That's my question.
It's a matter of how the Department of Finance is choosing to treat forecast. That's all.
And so your fix again, through the combination of sources, healthcare access reimbursement, and so on, is how much of a percentage of the total program for the rest of the biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't understand your question.
Are you fixing the entirety of the program for the rest of this biennium?
Yes.
Okay. But again, this is a temporary fix.
Yes.
And so, absent any action by the next legislature, we're back in the same predicament.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't take on solving this problem permanently. It was about as much as I could do to figure out how to solve it for the rest of this biennium. I'm not sure the funding source that we have is one that providers would be willing to continue with on a permanent basis. I know that the levels of reimbursement to providers in the bill are not sustainable over a very long period of time.
I mean, with the reduction in the reimbursement rates. So is it a fair statement that...
But I think it is also fair to say that we anticipate if federal reform is passed that this population would be picked up by the new federal program. And so this gives us time. It gives us the next 16 months. We solve part of our budget problem with this bill. We will then have time to analyze what the impact of federal reform would be on this population. And then we can decide how we want to fix the program if we need to fix it going forward.
Okay. So obviously this legislation allows you to take a step back, see what happens at a federal level, see if there's any impact on state programs.
I might just add, Mr. Chairman, that even without federal reform, it would be possible for Minnesota to apply for a waiver. I mean, there are a number of other states that have waivers that cover this population through Medicaid today. And that was one of the reasons the Senate included Minnesota in an early enrollment in Medicaid provision for this population so that we would be treated similar to how other states have been treated.
Okay. But what you're suggesting is that the Your temporary fix, which deals with reimbursement rates, deals with something from your perspective that's going to be unsustainable as a permanent fix.
Yes, I would say that.
And would it be a fair statement that providers who are impacted by the reimbursement rates are probably, from your work, not happy about it, but accepting given the emergency nature of the legislation?
Yes.
But those providers...
I think everyone realizes this population is still going to need to be served. And this amount of money that we're providing to providers to continue serving them will keep the doors open.
Okay. And the providers impacted by the reimbursement rate changes, although accepting on a temporary basis, are assuming that we'd have some more sustainable fix subsequent to this year's session in terms of the next biennium.
I think so.
Other questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, I'm trying to understand the $19 million in grant money that's been going to counties for, it said adult mental health and children's services. Are there other, I understand that this increases some mental health services, so maybe the counties will have less need for that. I'm not sure how we're going to balance that out when the counties lose that money, and especially for the children's services, because this is an adults program here. How are we justifying taking that money from there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, we anticipated that if the GAMC program were to go away, that the counties would have a certain level of expenses. Some of the expenses have been described by the chairman when he talked about transporting people via the sheriff or the local police. The counties have agreed with us that they have some costs if this program goes away. They did not want to be required to make a contribution in the form of a county share to the program. They preferred to have reductions made to appropriations. I think it's fair to say they would prefer to have those reductions made in local government aid. But I don't have local government aid in my division. And so we agreed that then the reasonable thing to do was to make grant cuts in areas that I did have in my budget. And so that's what's reflected in the bill.
Other questions? Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe one last comment. The counties fully acknowledge that they will have to backfill some of this grant reduction, especially in the children's services area, because it does help them fund their some of their child protection programs that they would be required to provide anyway. So there will be backfilling. There would have been backfilling if it would have been local government aid as well. But without the bill, they would have additional expenses in the budgets that they would then have rearranged money as well to cover.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, could you just give me the history of Section 4 in your bill? And I just want to understand, I thought last year we had, I can't remember, was it 2 years ago when we passed the rebasing, and then last year in the budget process, did we postpone or push back the dates?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, hospital rebasing has been in law for a long time. When we started having budget difficulties, we started delaying hospital rebasing. We have a delay in the law now. This section continues the delay 6 months longer. We believe that we would be doing this either in this bill or in a later bill in order to solve the budget problem. in this bill, I can't remember, I think it's around $9 million that this cut represents. But obviously, the solution to the hospitals is much bigger than a $9 million solution. And the solution to our budget deficit is much bigger than a $9 million solution. So it seemed as if it was a fair trade-off, although not desirable.
Okay. So do you foresee additional delays? I mean, we still have.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, I would say that as long as we're having budget deficits, it's going to be very, very difficult to fund hospital rebasing. It's a lot of money. And every year that we wait to do it, it adds money to that rebasing. So that would be my considered opinion. But the two hospital cuts that are in the bill, you need to remember they don't have this money now. And you know as well as I do as a budget chair, when you look for places to take money, if you can take money from people who don't have it yet, that's better than taking money from people who actually have it.
Further questions for Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, taking a look at the fiscal note, and actually the newer one now, the one we got this morning, you know, they talk about the substantial risk on in Section 33 because of that MCHA change, and I'm wondering, or I guess not really the assessment and the payback and that kind of thing, and I'm wondering,
Mr. Chairman,
you know.
Senator Fischbach, Congress has delayed the Bush administration rules on this program, and then subsequent to that, Obama administration has delayed the implementation of those rules. So at the current time, they're delayed until July 1st. We anticipate, I understand we could be wrong, but we're anticipating they will further delay implementation of those rules because they would have an adverse effect on a number of states. And this is not a time in our economy when the federal government really wants to have adverse impacts on states. So we could be wrong, and that's why they're noting it in the fiscal note, but we are anticipating that for the 16-month period we would have this program in effect, that we would be seeing those rules continue to be delayed.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if we did not do this, we would not be at risk if they implement the rules. I mean, eventually.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we could possibly be at risk for the existing surcharge we have in law. You know, everybody's forgotten about that, but that we do have some existing hospital and HMO surcharge in law now.
Okay. So you, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you would just say we're possibly at risk, but this may increase our risk. Is that a reasonable?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, as I said earlier, we have every reason to believe that these rules that might put us at risk will be delayed in terms of their implementation based on the past delays of these rules by the federal government. And so I believe it's a reasonable risk to take.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, could you explain to me
Senator Fischbach, at worst, we have $35 million on the line here that we would have to figure out another way to deal with. At worst, if I had to take $35 million out of the $168 million savings and just do it another way, I would do that. $35 million versus $400 million, I mean, it's not a very large amount of money that we're placing at risk here.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, could you just explain a little? You talked about the regents, and I know that some of this was covered in economic development yesterday, but maybe for the benefit, could you just explain that section a little more? Because I know that you went over it and explained that it was to Regents Hospital, but maybe just give a little more.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, as you know, Health Partners, as an entity, operates Regents Hospital. Regents Hospital is a safety net hospital in the metropolitan area that is greatly impacted by the loss of the GMC program. And so giving them this MSHA relief helps to further make it possible for them to absorb the losses that otherwise would occur as a result of that veto.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, why Regents in particular? I guess I'm wondering because they actually...
Partners is the only health plan that operates in the commercial market in a very big way and also has a major safety net hospital that's affected by the loss of GAMC. That's why.
Senator Berglund, if I can, I'm going to... Senator Fischbach's questions raise a concern that those of us who are in the geographies of HCMC and Regions maybe feel some concern that, you know, when we always try to just look at the geographies, who wins, who loses, people look at the Regions and HCMC as the winners. Under your proposal, do you have any sense of the numbers of people from other counties those hospitals handle as patients, or if there are people from those hospitals, if they could offer the numbers?
Well, maybe if somebody's here that would have those numbers, I'd ask them to come forward to answer the question. I believe the county serves every county in the state. I'm not sure about regions.
Okay, is there anybody from the hospital? Mr. Godfrey, would you like to? You've helped us in the past. You could help us again.
Chair, members, my name is David Godfrey, Public Policy Manager for Hennepin County Medical Center. I know that between regions and, well, I understand that, well, I can tell you that $50 million is the total loss of the GMC program to HCMC. Out of that $50 million, we believe that $8 to $12 million of it comes from residents outside of Hennepin County. And I'm not sure what region's number would be, but typically they are on a parallel track in terms of their GMC statistics as we are. So I would think if about 10 to 15% or 15% of our overall book of business of GMC comes from outside the county, I would assume that theirs would be fairly equivalent to that.
And could you quantify that in terms of number of patients or intakes?
Off the top of my head, I can't. I can certainly get that information to you. But it's 15% of our GMC book of business. So I would assume that it's roughly the same for our in terms of patients. Our overall patients, I believe, during the year is around 17,000, and so that would be 15% of that number, which is somewhere probably around 2,500.
You were more exacting when you were here previously than just kind of around 2,500, but that's okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I just Senator have Roblin. Some closing comments I'd like to make. If I notice the time
well,
here.
Yeah, Senator Roebling's got a question.
Senator Berglund, I'm still trying to understand how these surcharges work and exactly who they're going to affect. Now, I see that we're going to have a 4% surcharge on the health maintenance organizations. Now, does that transfer into a 4% increase for people who are paying premiums? So if you pay $10,000 a year in premiums for your HMO, it's going to be $400 a year. I'm trying to figure out who's actually picking up the cost for this and how it is being brought down to the consumer or when we say the hospital's going to pay it or the HMO, I don't really believe that it's going to come out of their pockets. So it has to come out of the pockets of those who usually contribute to those organizations. So I'm trying to
Chairman
understand.
And Senator Roebling, that is not correct. This is a financing mechanism to draw federal funds into our state. So, yes, the HMOs have this surcharge. We collect the money from them. But then in the bill, we give them a rate increase. That offsets what they gave us, and we keep the federal funds that we've brought into the state with this surcharge money to pay for this bill. And so if somebody is paying for it, you could say It is the rest of the people in the United States of America that are paying for this. Remember, however, we get less than our fair share of Medicare dollars. So we subsidize all the rest of the people in the United States of America when it comes to Medicare, and other states are collecting surcharge money that we are paying for. So this is an attempt to help us get some federal money at a time when we badly need it to help a population that is very, very vulnerable and needs this health care. And that's who's paying for it, is the other people in the other 49 states.
Pretty quick.
Okay. Further questions? If not, Senator Vickerman?
Mine is just a comment. Today, I don't know if a lot of you know it or not, is Veterans Day at the Capitol. I'm going to be there. The governor's going to be there. Senator Bergman, you're going to be there.
Look at
this bill.
Be there if I get out of here in time.
What this does for veterans who don't have any help. They don't have any place to go. And if we can't find them enough money, if we can't support veterans, then there's something wrong with us. They put their life on the line. They did. And some of them don't show up for needing help for, you know, maybe 5-6 years. But we have to have a place that they can go and not on the street.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, I'm glad you brought it up. About 16% of the GMC population that has served are veterans. And we believe that's an important, one of the important reasons to vote for this bill. And it could be anybody. I mean, that just points out that it could be any of us. I had a constituent who came out of her precinct caucus on precinct caucus night to catch me in the hall of the school. And she said to me, I want to say thank you, Senator Berglund, for your GMC bill. I know a lot of people on the program are hurting so bad they won't be able to thank you. I was on the program once. I'm not on it anymore, but I want to say thank you for all of those people. And so it could be any of us. If you get sick and you lose your job, that often means you've lost your health care. Sometimes it means you're going to lose your house because you don't have any income. And if you don't have any access to medical care to take care of the medical problem that started all of it in the first place, then you're never going to recover from it. And I would say, you know, a certain percentage of the 85,000 people affected by this bill will die. So if you have access to this program as a person without children in your household any longer, you're going to be able to get the health care you need to get yourself back on your feet and to get yourself back being able to function in society again. We have a lot of people in this program who are applying for Social Security disability. Without the access to health care and the health care records they need, they will not be successful in making that application. This bill is paid for. The governor's plan to auto-enroll people in Minnesota Care is not paid for. In fact, it creates a bigger deficit for us. And if that plan is allowed to stand, mark my words, you'll see a budget bill from the governor that will decimate Minnesota Care. And Senator Fischbach, this bill may not be as friendly to some small rural hospitals as you would like it to be, or as I would like it to be. But if we start eliminating Minnesota Care, those hospitals are going to be greatly affected by the loss of that revenue. So we're in it together. It's a hospital system. It's a healthcare system that we fund in Minnesota. And this bill will keep Minnesota Care solvent, so there will be no need to make reductions in that population that is the safety net for rural Minnesota hospitals. So I would ask people to vote for this bill today. I think it's the right thing to do. Certainly, we can use the federal money in regard to helping us solve this problem and our budget problem.
Mr. Chairman?
Chair Olson.
Mr. Chairman, just what Senator Vickerman said just triggered a question in my mind. What reasons are there for why veterans are not covered by VA, Veterans Administration, for health care?
No. Mr. Chairman, sometimes they are, or it might be that whatever's happening to them is not, you know, related to their military service. Today we have veterans that are in the theater of action that, you know, they're guard, reservists, and they're not covered by the federal VA medical programs. So some people might not be covered by the VA programs. Other people might be using this program until they can get the VA program to kick in for them. And then the VA program would take over.
The VA health service is only if there's injury suffered as a result of being in the military.
Service-connected.
For all other
service
veterans.
Connect, it has to be service-connected, and they have to have been an enlisted soldier as opposed to being in the Guard.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 2168 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion on the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.